You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. If You Can't Take the Heat, Tales of Food, Feminism, and Fury by Geraldine DeRuiter. Geraldine DeRuiter, the pungent voice behind the Everywhereist blog, knows how to rant. You may have read her fiery rejoinder to the cinnamon roll recipe that the chef Mario Batali appended to his 2017 apology for sexual misconduct. Not only was attaching a recipe visibly tone-deaf, DeRuiter concluded in her James Beard award-winning piece, but the recipe itself was sexist, a time-waster foisted on the group likeliest to bake the oddly savory rolls, women. Or perhaps you caught DeRuiter's viral takedown of an abysmal dinner at a Michelin-starred restaurant. Haughty waiters served meat molecules squirted from an eyedropper and rancido ricotta. "You mean fermented? Aged?" she asked. "No," her server told her, "rancid." To Reuters' assessment, this was single-handedly one of the worst wastes of money in my entire food and travel writing career. Wahaha, oh my God. Brimming with venom and verve, these two pieces, both of which appear in her new book, If You Can't Take the Heat, Tales of Food, Feminism, and Fury, showcase De Reuter's mastery of irony, profanity, and stream-of-consciousness indignation. The essays that fill out the collection, a grab bag of the autobiographical and polemical, are characteristically lively, though they highlight significant gaps in De Reuter's skill set. De Reuter's parents divorced when she was young, and she grew up with her Italian mother, like a tiny, loud, leopard print-clad carnival in Seattle and Florida. Her mother features here as an agent of mostly benign chaos. She accidentally burns her house down, and, perhaps more shockingly, suggests De Reuter eat an 18-inch-long hare that turns up in a slice of pie. De Reuter devotes one essay to her father, a spy whose cover was to present himself as boring, the human equivalent of a tasseled loafer. "Do you know how hard it was for a 5-year-old me to convince a man like that I needed the 1984 Loving You Barbie, with mini stationery set included, or I would absolutely die," De Reuter writes with typical theatricality. She attempts to understand this opaque man by studying the history of beef stroganoff, one of the few dishes he cooked, and mastering the recipe. The experiment draws shaky parallels between the Eastern European origins of both stroganoff and her father, and yields no satisfying conclusions. The bedrock relationship of De Reuter's life is her long marriage to her genial husband, Rand, who does not run away in horror when he sees me tear connective tissue from bone like a raptor while eating. Nor does Rand run away in horror when she screams, snaps, and shouts at him, something she describes herself doing on the regular. She reports screaming whenever they pass a Red Lobster, with the urgency of someone who has been stabbed with something very sharp, because she loves the chain just that much. Sometimes Rand tells her she's great. Her retort, "Why? What is broken about you that makes you think that?" I often scream back. The reader begins to wonder the same thing. De Reuter has an all-eyes-on-me narrative persona, ravenous, pugnacious, irrational, and loud. Unmodulated, her voice is ideal for delivering a rant, but it can overwhelm less flammable material. One of her overarching gripes, a rightful gripe, is about the way women blunt their anger and soften their voices in order to placate and please. But women can also soften their voices in order to persuade and illuminate. There are some wonderful observations in De Reuter's pan to the reader responses you find on cooking sites, that tender section of user-generated comments beyond the end of a recipe. She has discovered poignant personal tales and beguiling humanity there, hiding in plain sight in the maelstrom of the internet. But rather than exploring this tranquil space with delicacy and gentle wit, she swamps it with salty all-caps asides and sarcastic mini-diatribes. an essay on her decision not to have children is larded with nonsensical observations, including a meditation on the dearth of successful childless women, baffling given how many such women De Ruyter mentions elsewhere in the book. She pads the piece with elaborations, both serious and fanciful, on the benefits of not becoming a parent. Here's one particularly lazy, unfunny line, geared towards showing how wacky she is. I regularly make cake at 9 p.m. and eat it by 9:30 p.m., knowing that I don't need to set a good example for anyone. There are hundreds of great reasons to forego children. This isn't a great reason. It's not even a reason. Mothers can also eat cake at 9:30 p.m. Describing her childhood food preferences, which ran to raw potatoes, toothpaste, and entrails, De Ruyter writes, if it caused someone to raise their eyebrows in a measure of alarm or admiration or exasperation, I would eat it. The same craving for attention shapes her writing. While reading this book, my eyebrows were sometimes raised in admiration, too often, sadly, in exasperation. This review was written by Jennifer Reese, whose work has appeared in the Book Review and the Washington Post. How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler, by Peter Pomerantsev. In 1931, the British journalist Sefton Delmer interviewed Adolf Hitler, whose long-shot presidential campaign he was covering for a British paper. I realized in a flash the secret to his power, Delmer wrote in the Daily Express. Hitler had mesmerized millions of men and women into fanatical allegiance with his impassioned gaze and personal zealotry. Delmer's articles flattered the Nazi top brass. He threw parties for them and in return got scoops. Britain's embassy in Berlin took notice, reporting home that Delmer was probably the only one outside the charmed circle who had the connections to gather so many Nazi luminaries. When war broke out in 1939, British intelligence recruited Delmer to deploy his knowledge of Nazi propaganda toward countering it. I think we should try out a new type of black radio on the Germans, Delmer suggested. One that undermines Hitler, not by opposing him, but by pretending to be all for him and his war. Delmer ran his faux Nazi broadcasts out of a radio station in Asbly Gies, a village 40 miles from London. The first show aired in 1941. 8 decades later, another British journalist, Peter Pomerantsev, experienced his own flash of realization while surveying rising militarism in Europe. Pomerantsev was born in Kyiv. In 2022, he visited the Ukrainian town of Bukha as it emerged from a month-long Russian military occupation. Survivors recounted mass-scale execution, torture, and rape. They've been fed so much brain-destroying propaganda, a Ukrainian general said of the Russians as he led Pomerantsev and others on a tour of the destruction. Gesturing to body bags filled with civilians, he added, "This is created by the propaganda." In How to Win an Information War, Pomerantsev weaves accounts of present-day Russian disinformation into a biography of Delmer and a close read of his radio programs. In his efforts to undermine the Nazis, the revolutionary Delmer, Pomerantsev argues, discovered powerful, if uncomfortable, truths about human nature that, more relevant than ever, could help to turn back authoritarianism's march today. Pomerantsev offers a sometimes colorful story of Delmer's exploits, but he never delivers on this timely promise. The lessons of How to Win an Information War are mostly relegated to familiar bromides. What we need to do is give people the motivation to care about truth again. We can gain even the most skeptical audience's attention if we understand their motivations. And what we hear of the broadcast is hardly revolutionary. Between well wishes to German U-boat crews and chipper dance tunes, Delmer reported on German frontline setbacks and avarice among party elite. He also encouraged listeners to take sleeping pills, hoping they might doze through air raids, and claimed that the wives of Nazi officials were buying up textiles in anticipation of a shortage. To Delmer's delight, a newspaper in Kyiv later blamed the rumor for a run on the town's clothing stores. Pomerantsev credits Delmer with kindling his German audience's desire to think for themselves again, to fall in love with finding facts. But many of these antics seem designed to harm his audience, not to awaken them. Off the air, his colleagues produced pamphlets encouraging German soldiers to escape duty by faking illness. Delmer hoped the manuals would also seed distrust between military medics and their Nazi patients, making them harder to treat for real ailments. Did Delmer's trickery threaten the Third Reich? The broadcasts did vex the Nazi propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, enough to reportedly come up in his meeting notes. But Michael Balfour, a veteran of the British propaganda effort, who later chronicled it as a historian, concluded that the campaign must be said to have failed. The Nazis had fought to the bitter end. Uprisings and desertions did not break them from within. Pomerantsev acknowledges this, but argues that Delmer may have helped provoke German soldiers into surrendering. He presents no real evidence, though. Similarly unsupported in his contention that a failed plot to assassinate Hitler, led by members of the German military, demonstrated that Delmer had managed to influence the behavior of a specific group of people and help bolster an action that, if it had worked, would have severely undermined the Nazis. Things become even more dubious when Pomerantsev explores the theories of psychoanalysis, then in vogue, that animated British counter-propaganda efforts. One feels for Pomerantsev, who, having insisted on Delmer's brilliance, must also agree, for example, that Nazism is a form of sadomasochism, or that Germans possessed a lust for self-immolation, part of an unconscious death drive that Delmer sought to cultivate. Pomerantsev's indulgence in mid-century psychobabble may help explain why Delmer arrived at the methods that he did, but it doesn't go a long way in advancing 21st century warfare. We are living through a golden age in peer-reviewed social science. Consider how useful a counter-propagandist might find the research linking support for autocracy to rapid changes in social hierarchies, or to certain forms of income inequality. But Pomerantsev, having made himself a prisoner to his claim that Delmer was a genius of propaganda whose playbook outwitted Hitler, cannot avail himself of this knowledge. In its place, How to Win an Information War rests on a central, albeit mostly implicit, thesis. If people rally behind a government that you or I find abhorrent, it must be because they have been manipulated into doing so and can be manipulated out of it. Propaganda matters. It can, for instance, nudge its targets a few more degrees in a direction that they already want to go. But can it really be blamed for the human draw to despotism and mass violence? All this requires ignoring an alternative explanation for Hitler's rise or Russian atrocities in Ukraine, one for which history and social science alike provide a great deal of evidence. Many people will, under certain circumstances, support authoritarianism, militarism, even genocide with their eyes wide open because they find these things appealing. The German thirst for war may not have been a front in the propaganda war at all, which is perhaps why Delmer never won it. This review was written by Max Fischer, who is a New York-based international reporter and columnist. He has reported from 5 continents on conflict, diplomacy, social change, and other topics. Victim by Andrew Borgia. There's real value in being a victim, serious profit in pity, but only as long as you don't become too ambitious, too greedy, or too arrogant. Veer too far and you run the risk of becoming dependent on disaster. That's when real trouble ensues. And that's exactly what happens to Javi Perez, the hustling Icarus at the center of Andrew Borgia's energetic and deeply satisfying debut novel, Victim. The story, which is presented as a memoir written by Javi himself, is at once an act of redemption and condemnation. As Javi explains in the first sentence, "I wasn't trying to play the victim until the world taught me what a powerful grift it is." Borgia's novel opens with Javi's youth. He was born in the Bronx to working-class Puerto Rican immigrants. To outside eyes, his background is rough, but from his own perspective, it's not hell. Misfortune does eventually manifest for Javi when, at 12, he witnesses his father's fatal shooting. Surprisingly, he's only shaken, because, as Javi explains, he was losing a person who was only kind of there. However, Javi soon learns that within tragedy lies opportunity. Assuming he's traumatized, his teachers give him a free pass to go to the nurse whenever he wants, which he frequently uses to cut class. It's his first taste of the high that comes from being a victim. Javi's main goal in life is to become a famous writer who makes bank, but before that, college. He assumes he'll just go somewhere local, but his guidance counselor, Mr. Martin, urges him to consider more prestigious institutions, like Donlan University, which offers full-ride scholarships for poor, underserved minority students. The key to these scholarships is to write an essay stuffed with tragedy and trauma, basically catnip for the admissions committee. I had never thought about my life in that way, Javi muses. In his eyes, he's not a victim. He's not poor, but poorish. Still, Javi writes the essay, and it works. He gains entrance to Donlan. It's a critical lesson that teaches our inner-city Icarus how to fly. Javi realizes that his personal history and his skin color can be a goldmine, and that with people like Mr. Martin, I was rich. His ascent continues at Donlan, where he becomes the first Latino columnist of the school newspaper in its 100-year existence. But instead of writing his truth, he constantly stretches it, lying about various instances of victimization. And just as they did with his college essay, people eat it up. His editors place his first column prominently on the front page, and his exaggerated and outright manufactured writings bring Javi more and more success, earning him first attention, then freelance pieces in a famous magazine, then a job as a staff writer at the storied publication. But like Icarus with his wings of wax, Javi learns that counterfeit fabrications eventually fall apart. In Victim, Borja skillfully conveys that victim is often an external label slapped onto us. It was in one of my very first classes, Javi hilariously recounts, that I learned something profound. I am a victim of systemic oppression. But whether we rock it proudly or reject it loudly is up to us. Regardless, every choice comes with a consequence. It's a thorny and nuanced conversation, but Borja handles it judiciously. His prose is animated and active. His character writing is a crowning achievement. The people who populate the book are, at first glance, so familiar that they could devolve into caricature. But with Borja's empathetic prose and startling self-awareness, they come to life with beating hearts and distinct personalities without sacrificing veracity. The sum of this is a story that reads like an enthralling account told by a friend rather than some stuffy, moralistic, cautionary tale. Borja is having fun, and he's inviting us to join in. But let's be clear, though Borja is playing, he's not playing around. Through Javi's story, Borja humorously and scathingly calls out the gluttonous consumption of stories of victimhood. Javi's scam is possible only because he understands that people will all too willingly and uncritically embrace tales of woe in order to reinforce their own sense of self and morals, especially in public. The perils of this, the novel suggests, are twofold. It strips victims of their personhood, reducing them to faces on t-shirts and pixels on a screen, while also cultivating a society fertile for fraud. Yes, Borja's critiques are uncomfortable and entirely necessary. His debut signals the arrival of a writer courageous enough to dive into the difficult head-on. A thrilling work that requires a sense of openness and surrender, not only does this novel place the onus on us to decide whether Javi is a victim, a victimizer, or both, it also forces us to interrogate our own complicity in the commodification of being a casualty. Because, as Javi says, life ain't neat. No one among us is righteous. This review was written by Matteo Ascaripour. His debut novel is Black Buck. His second novel, This Great Hemisphere, will be published in July. Your Utopia, Stories by Bora Chung. We were promised a future full of innovation, a tomorrow filled with sleek technologies that would whisk us far away from the most mundane aspects of our humanity. Technology has indeed gotten sleeker, so why do we seem so stubbornly the same? The wistful, emotionally unmoored protagonists of the Korean writer Bora Chung's second story collection, Your Utopia, Stories, translated by Anton Herr, do their best to navigate this quandary. In one story, a low-level employee at the Center for Immortality Research organizes an anniversary party at the institution, even as the question of her own immortality hovers in the background. In another, a highly contagious disease that causes cannibalism sweeps the planet, eventually reaching a spaceship where the government is working desperately to develop a cure. The epidemic is horrifying, but that doesn't prevent Chung from finding humor in it. Aside from the afflicted's tendency to regard other people as food, they were completely normal, she writes. It was only when cannibalism was mentioned in conversation that they responded abnormally, most notably their uniform insistence that eating people did not kill the eaten. Chung builds out her stories with imagination, absurdity, and a dry sense of humor, all applied with exacto knife precision. But what stands out about her fantastical tales is not how different they are from one another, so much as how much remains the same. No matter the premise behind a story, jobs still suck, suffering is still the natural product of living under society's thumb, and not even looming threats, like the danger of being eaten, can keep people from adhering to familiar structures of authority. All of this might sound grim, but Chung's deft handling makes these fraught obediences and tender concerns feel powerfully human. In the title story, for instance, a sentient self-driving vehicle left on Earth after humans have fled the planet finds meaning in ferrying around a damaged robot. Though the vehicle is only a smart object, its experience is richly emotive and tinged by the paradoxical effects that circulate at the end of the world. If I want to conserve energy during the sunless nights, I need to think less. But here I am in the dark, having thoughts about having fewer thoughts. Same, bestie. This review was written by Alexandra Kleeman, who is a novelist and Guggenheim Fellow, and the author most recently of Something New Under the Sun. The Bandit Queens by Perini Schroff. Since Gita's abusive husband abandoned her, fellow villagers have whispered that she killed him. The rumors sting until her friend Farah asks if Gita can help her do the same. While its premise might sound grim, this feel-good debut demonstrates how the antidote to bleak circumstances is female friendship. Saha by Cho Nam-ju, translated by Jamie Chang. Town, a city-state that is not quite company or country, enforces a multi-tiered class system. Laboring under it are the citizenship-less, referred to by the name of the decrepit apartment complex where they live. The Saha estates are where authorities turn when a doctor is murdered, and where Jin Kyung decides to fight back for her missing brother, her neighbors, and herself. Symphony of Secrets by Brendan Slocum. This thriller follows Byrne, a music professor, and Ebony, a tech expert, as they retrace the creation of a long-lost, recently resurfaced opera by Byrne's favorite composer. As they realize the composer's reputation isn't what it seems, the book makes audible the chords that echo between present and past. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.